A Response by Ansible from Tao Ceti. This piece first appeared in the New Utopian Politics of Ursula K. Le Guin's The Dispossessed, edited by Lawrence Davis and Peter Stillman, Lexington Books, 2005. It is a general response to the articles in that book. I revised it slightly for this book in 2014. I've spent a good deal of vehemence objecting to the reduction of fiction to ideas. Readers, I think, are often led astray by the widespread belief that a novel springs from a single originating idea, and then are kept astray by the critical practice of discussing fiction as completely accessible to intellect, a rational presentation of ideas by means of an essentially ornamental narrative. In discussing novels that clearly deal with social, political, or ethical issues, and above all, in discussing science fiction, supposed to be a literature of ideas, this practice is so common, particularly in teaching and academic texts, that it has driven me to slightly lunatic extremes of protest. In reaction to it, I find myself talking as if intellect had nothing to do with novel writing or novel reading, speaking of composition as a pure trance state, and asserting that all I seek when writing is to allow my unconscious mind to control the course of the story, using rational thought only to reality check when revising. All this is perfectly true, but it's only half the picture. It's because the other half of the picture is so often the only one shown and discussed that I counterreact to the point of sounding woo-woo. When critics treat me, even with praise, as a methodical axe grinder, I am driven to deny that there's any didactic intention at all in my fiction. Of course there is. I hope I have avoided preaching, but the teaching impulse is often stronger than I am. Still, I'd rather be praised for my efforts to resist it than for my failures. Even in quite sophisticated criticism, the naive conflation of what a character, particularly a sympathetic one, says with what the author believes will goad me into denying that I agree with what the character says, even when I do. How else can I assert the fact that a character's voice is never to be taken for the author's? Je suis Madame Bovary, said Flaubert, groaning as usual. I say, j'aime Chevec, mais je ne suis pas Chevec. I envy Homer and Shakespeare, who by being only semi-existent evade such impertinent assimilations. They retain effortlessly the responsible detachment which I must consciously and never wholly successfully labor to achieve. So The Dispossessed, a science fiction novel not only concerned with politics, society, and ethics, but approaching them via a definite political theory, has given me a lot of grief. It has generally, not always, but often, been discussed as a treatise, not as a novel. This is its own damn fault, of course. What did it expect, announcing itself as a utopia, even if an ambiguous one? Everybody knows utopias are to be read not as novels, but as blueprints for social theory or practice. But the fact is that, starting with Plato's Republic in Philosophy 1A when I was 17, I read utopias as novels. Actually, I still read everything as novels, including history, memoir, and the newspaper. I think Borges is quite correct. All prose is fiction. So when I came to write a utopia, of course, I wrote a novel. I wasn't surprised that it was treated as a treatise, but I wondered if the people who read it as a treatise ever wondered why I had written it as a novel. Were they as indifferent as they seemed to be to what made it a novel? The inherent self-contradictions of novelistic narrative that prevent simplistic, single-theme interpretation, the novelistic thickness of description, Geertz's term, that resists reduction to abstracts and binaries, the embodiment of ethical dilemma in a drama of character that evades allegorical interpretation, the presence of symbolic elements that are not fully accessible to rational thought? You will understand, perhaps, why I approached this collection of essays about the dispossessed with my head down and my shoulders hunched. Experience had taught me to expect a set of intellectual exercises which, even if not accusing me of preaching, moralizing, political naivete, compulsive heterosexuality, screeching feminism, or bourgeois cowardice, even if interested in or supportive of what the book says, would prove essentially indifferent to how it says it. If fiction is how it says what it says, then useful criticism is what shows you how fiction says what it says. To my grateful surprise, that's what this collection does. These essays are not about an idea of the book. They are about the book. Perhaps I can express my gratitude best by saying that reading them left me knowing far better than I knew before how I wrote the book and why I wrote it as I did. By seldom exaggerating the intentionality of the text, they have freed me from exaggerating its non-intentionality, allowing me once more to consider what I wanted to do and how I tried to do it. They have restored the book to me as I conceived it, not as an exposition of ideas, but as an embodiment of idea. A revolutionary artifact, a work containing a potential permanent source of renewal of thought and perception, like a William Morris design, or the Bernard Maybeck house I grew up in. These critics show me how the events and relationships of the narrative, which as I wrote the book seemed to follow not an arbitrary but not a rationally decided course, do constitute an architecture which is fundamentally aesthetic and which, in being so, fulfills an intellectual or rational design. They enable me to see the system of links and echoes, of leaps and recurrences that make the narrative structure work. This is criticism as I first knew it, serious, responsive, and jargon-free. I honor it as an invaluable aid to reading, my own text as well as others. Though I had pretty well saturated my mind with utopian literature, with the literature of pacifist anarchism, and with temporal physics, insofar as it existed, before I wrote the book, my knowledge of relevant theoretical thinking was very weak. When I read recurrent citations in these essays, Hegel above all, Bakhtin, Adorno, Marcuse, and many more, I hunch up a bit again. I am embarrassed. My capacity for sustained abstract thought is somewhat above that of a spaniel. I knew and know these authors only by name and reputation. The book was not written under their influence, and they can't be held responsible, positively or negatively, for anything in my text. At most, as with The Shadow in Carl Jung and in A Wizard of Earthsea, it is interesting to observe parallels or intersections of thought. On the other hand, I was glad to see my thought experiment tested against the writers who did contribute to its formation. Above all, Lao Tzu, Kropotkin, and Paul Goodman. A good many of the writers in this book treat The Dispossessed as if it stood quite alone in my work. This ahistorical approach seems odd, since the book has been around so long and isn't an anomaly among my other works. It was followed in 1982 by a fairly lengthy discussion of utopias, a non-Euclidean view of California as a cold place to be, which forms a clear link to a second, if radically different, utopian novel, Always Coming Home, 1985. It's hard for me to put these out of my mind when thinking about The Dispossessed. Both offer a chance to compare some of the things I did in the earlier novel with things I said in the essay or did in the later novel, testing for consistency, change of mind, progress, regress, aesthetic and intellectual purpose. And also, the unanimity with which these writers refuse to read The Dispossessed as a single theme, monistic, close-minded text, makes me long to see some of them take on Always Coming Home, which has often been read, or dismissed unread, as a naively regressive picture of a sort of happy hunting ground for fake Indians, the narrative experimentation and the postmodernist self-conscious fictionality which some of these essayists point to in The Dispossessed are carried a great deal further in Always Coming Home. I, for one, am curious as to why I play these particular tricks only when writing utopias, or anyhow semi-utopias with flies in them. In some of these essays, I began to catch a glimpse of why, and I'd very much like to learn more. I found nothing really to correct, nothing I thought simply wrong, a misreading, in all these pages. I would point out that Hainish guilt is not unmotivated or mysterious. In other stories, one finds that the Hainish, everybody's ancestors, have a terribly long history which is, like all human histories, terrible. So Keto, who comes in at the end, is indeed cautious in his search for hope. But whether he finds it or not, the book does not say. And here I felt in a few of the essays a slight tendency to wishful thinking. The book doesn't have a happy ending. It has an open ending. As pointed out in at least one of the essays, it's quite possible that both Chevek and Keto will be killed on arrival by an angry mob. And it's only too likely that Chevek's specific plans and hopes for his people will come to little or nothing. That would not surprise Keto. And speaking of the end of the book, I must once again thank its first reader and first critic, Darko Suvin, who brought to my anarchist manuscript the merciless eye of a Marxist and the merciful mind of a friend. It had 12 chapters then, and a neat full-circle ending. 12 chapters? He cried, enraged. It should be an odd number. And what is this closure? You are not allowed to close this text. Is the circle open or not? The circle is open. The doors are open. In order to have doors to open, you have to have a house. To those who helped me build my drafty and imaginary house, and to those who have brought to it their generous comment and keen perception, making its rooms come alive with resounding and unending arguments, I am grateful. Be welcome, Amari.